Chapter 3. When the miner comes up from the pit, his face is so pale that it is noticeable even through the mask of coal dust. This is due to the foul air that he has been breathing, and will wear off presently. To a southerner, new to the mining districts, the spectacle of a shift of several hundred miners streaming out of the pit is strange and slightly sinister. Their exhausted faces, with the grime clinging in all the hollows, have a fierce, wild look. At other times, when their faces are clean, there is not much to distinguish them from the rest of the population. They have a very upright square-shouldered walk, a reaction from the constant bending underground, but most of them are shortish men and their thick ill-fitting clothes hide the splendor of their bodies. The most definitely distinctive thing about them is the blue scars on their noses. Every miner has blue scars on his nose and forehead, and will carry them to his death. The coal dust of which the air underground is full enters every cut, and then the skin grows over it and forms a blue stain like tattooing, which in fact it is. Some of the older men have their foreheads veined like Roquefort cheeses from this cause. As soon as the miner comes above ground, he gargles a little water to get the worst of the coal dust out of his throat and nostrils, and then goes home and either washes or does not wash according to his temperament. From what I have seen, I should say that a majority of miners prefer to eat their meal first and wash afterwards, as I should do in their circumstances. It is the normal thing to see a miner sitting down to his tea with a crusty minstrel face, completely black except for very red lips which become clean by eating. After his meal he takes a largish basin of water and washes very methodically, first his hands, then his chest, neck and armpits, then his forearms, then his face and scalp. It is on the scalp that the grime clings thickest. And then his wife takes the flannel and washes his back. He has only washed the top half of his body and probably his navel is still a nest of coal dust, but even so it takes some skill to get passably clean in a single basin of water. For my own part, one found I needed two complete baths after going down a coal mine. Getting the dirt out of one's eyelids is a 10 minutes job in itself. At some of the larger and better appointed collieries there are pit head baths. This is an enormous advantage, for not only can the miner wash himself all over every day, in comfort and even luxury, but at the baths he has two lockers where he can keep his pit clothes separate from his day clothes. So that within 20 minutes of emerging as black as a negro he can be riding off to a football match dressed up to the nines. But it is only comparatively few mines that have baths, partly because a seam of coal does not last forever, so that it is not necessarily worth building a bath every time a shaft is sunk. I cannot get hold of exact figures, but it seems likely that rather less than one miner in three has access to a pithead bath. Probably a large majority of miners are completely black from the waist down for at least 6 days a week. It is almost impossible for them to wash all over in their own homes. Every drop of water has got to be heated up, and in a tiny living room which contains, apart from the kitchen range and a quantity of furniture, a wife, some children and probably a dog, there is simply not room to have a proper bath. Even with a basin one is bound to splash the furniture. Middle-class people are fond of saying that the miners would not wash themselves properly even if they could, but this is nonsense, as is shown by the fact that where pithead baths exist practically all the men use them. Only among the very old men does the belief still linger that washing one's legs causes lumbago. Moreover, the pithead baths, where they exist, are paid for wholly or partly by the miners themselves, out of the miners' welfare fund. Sometimes the colliery company subscribes, sometimes the fund bears the whole cost. But doubtless even at this late date the old ladies in Brighton boarding houses are saying that, if you give those miners baths they only use them to keep coal in. As a matter of fact it is surprising that miners wash as regularly as they do, seeing how little time they have between work and sleep. It is a great mistake to think of a miner's working day as being only 7.5 hours. 7.5 hours is the time spent actually on the job, but, as I have already explained, one has got to add on to this time taken up in traveling, which is seldom less than an hour and may often be 3 hours. In addition, most miners have to spend a considerable time in getting to and from the pit. Throughout the industrial districts there is acute shortage of houses, and it is only in the small mining villages, where the village is grouped round the pit, that the men can be certain of living near their work. In the larger mining towns where I have stayed, nearly everyone went to work by bus. Half a crown a week seemed to be the normal amount to spend on fares. One miner I stayed with was working on the morning shift, which was from 6 in the morning till 1:30. He had to be out of bed at 3:45 and got back somewhere after 3 in the afternoon. In another house where I stayed, a boy of 15 was working on the night shift. He left for work at 9 at night and got back at 8 in the morning, had his breakfast and then promptly went to bed and slept till 6 in the evening. So that his leisure time amounted to about 4 hours a day, actually a good deal less, if you take off the time for washing, eating and dressing. The adjustments a miner's family have to make when he is changed from one shift to another must be tiresome in the extreme. If he is on the night shift, he gets home in time for breakfast, on the morning shift he gets home in the middle of the afternoon, and on the afternoon shift he gets home in the middle of the night. And in each case, of course, he wants his principal meal of the day as soon as he returns. I notice that the Rev. W. R. Inga, in his book England, accuses the miners of gluttony. From my own observation, I should say that they eat astonishingly little. Most of the miners I stayed with ate slightly less than I did. Many of them declare that they cannot do their day's work if they have had a heavy meal beforehand, and the food they take with them is only a snack, usually bread and dripping and cold tea. They carry it in a flat tin called a snapkin, which they strap to their belts. When a miner gets back late at night, his wife waits up for him, but when he is on the morning shift, it seems to be the custom for him to get his breakfast for himself. Apparently, the old superstition that it is bad luck to see a woman before going to work on the morning shift is not quite extinct. In the old days, it is said, a miner who happened to meet a woman in the early morning would often turn back and do no work that day. Before I had been in the coal areas, I shared the widespread illusion that miners are comparatively well paid. One hears it loosely stated that a miner is paid 10 or 11 shillings a shift, and one does a small multiplication sum and concludes that every miner is earning round about £3 a week or £150 a year. But the statement that a miner receives 10 or 11 shillings a shift is very misleading. To begin with, it is only the actual coal getter who is paid at this rate. A daedler, for instance, who attends to the roofing, is paid at a lower rate, usually 8 or 9 shillings a shift. Again, when the coal getter is paid piecework, so much per ton extracted, as is the case in many mines, he is dependent on the quality of the coal. A breakdown in the machinery or a fault, that is, a streak of rock running through the coal seam, may rob him of his earnings for a day or two at a time. But in any case, one ought not to think of the miner as working 6 days a week, 52 weeks a year. Almost certainly there will be a number of days when he is laid off. The average earning per shift worked for every mine worker, of all ages and both sexes, in Great Britain in 1934, was 9s. 1/3d. 1 if everyone were in work all the time, this would mean that the mine worker was earning a little over £142 a year, or nearly £2.15 a week. His real income, however, is far lower than this, for the 9s. 1/3d. is merely an average calculation on shifts actually worked and takes no account of blank days. I have before me 5 paychecks belonging to a Yorkshire miner, for 5 weeks, not consecutive, at the beginning of 1936. Averaging them up, the gross weekly wage they represent is £2.15. 2d, this is an average of nearly 9s. 2/1d a shift. But these paychecks are for the winter, when nearly all mines are running full time. As spring advances, the coal trade slacks off and more men are temporarily stopped, while others still technically in work are laid off for a day or two in every week. It is obvious, therefore, that £150 or even £142 is an immense overestimate for the mine worker's yearly income. As a matter of fact, for the year 1934, the average gross earnings of all miners throughout Great Britain was only £115.11. 6d. It varied considerably from district to district, rising as high as £133.2s. 8d, in Scotland, while in Durham it was a little under £105 or barely more than £2 a week. I take these figures from the Coal Scuttle, by Mr. Joseph Jones, Mayor of Barnsley, Yorkshire. Mr. Jones adds, these figures cover the earnings of youths as well as adults and of the higher as well as the lower paid grades. Any particularly high earning would be included in these figures, as would the earnings of certain officials and other higher paid men as well as the higher amounts paid for overtime work. The figures, being averages, fail to reveal the position of thousands of adult workers whose earnings were substantially below the average and who received only 30s to 40s or less per week. Mr. Jones's italics. But please notice that even these wretched earnings are gross earnings. On top of this, there are all kinds of stoppages which are deducted from the miners' wages every week. Here is a list of weekly stoppages which was given me as typical in one Lancashire district. S. D. Insurance, unemployment and health. 1. 5. Hire of lamp. 6. For sharpening tools. 6. Checkweighman. 9. Infirmary. 2. Hospital. 1. Benevolent fund. 6. Union fees. 6. Total. 4. 5. Some of these stoppages, such as the benevolent fund and the union fees, are, so to speak, the miner's own responsibility, others are imposed by the colliery company. They are not the same in all districts. For instance, the iniquitous swindle of making the miner pay for the hire of his lamp, at sixpence a week he buys the lamp several times over in a single year, does not obtain everywhere. But the stoppages always seem to total up to about the same amount. On the Yorkshire miners' 5 paychecks, the average gross earning per week is £2.15. 2d, the average net earning, after the stoppages have come off, is only £2.10. 6.5d. A reduction of 4s. 7.5d a week. But the paycheck, naturally, only mentions stoppages which are imposed by or paid through the colliery company. One has got to add the union fees, bringing the total reduction up to something over 4 shillings. Probably it is safe to say that stoppages of one kind and another cut 4 shillings or thereabouts from every adult miner's weekly wage. So that the £115.11s. 6d. Which was the mine worker's average earning throughout Great Britain in 1934 should really be something nearer £105. As against this, most miners receive allowances in kind, being able to purchase coal for their own use at a reduced rate, usually 8 or 9 shillings a ton. But according to Mr. Jones, quoted above, the average value of all allowances in kind for the country as a whole is only 4 pence a day. And this 4 pence a day is offset, in many cases, by the amount the miner has to spend on fares in getting to and from the pit. So, taking the industry as a whole, the sum the miner can actually bring home and call his own does not average more, perhaps slightly less, than £2 a week. Meanwhile, how much coal is the average miner producing? The tonnage of coal raised yearly per person employed in mining rises steadily though rather slowly. In 1914 every mine worker produced, on an average, 253 tons of coal, in 1934 he produced 280 tons. To this of course is an average figure for mine workers of all kinds, those actually working at the coal face extract an enormously greater amount, in many cases, probably, well over 1,000 tons each. But taking 280 tons as a representative figure, it is worth noticing what a vast achievement this is. One gets the best idea of it by comparing a miner's life work with somebody else's. If I live to be 60, I shall probably have produced 30 novels, or enough to fill 2 medium-sized library shelves. In the same period, the average miner produces 8,400 tons of coal. Enough coal to pave Trafalgar Square nearly 2 feet deep or to supply 7 large families with fuel for over 100 years. Of the five paychecks I mentioned above, no less than three are rubber-stamped with the words, death stoppage. When a miner is killed at work, it is usual for the other miners to make up a subscription, generally of a shilling each, for his widow, and this is collected by the colliery company and automatically deducted from their wages. The significant detail here is the rubber stamp. The rate of accidents among miners is so high, compared with that in other trades, that casualties are taken for granted almost as they would be in a miner war. Every year one miner in about 900 is killed and one in about 6 is injured. Most of these injuries, of course, are petty ones, but a fair number amount to total disablement. This means that if a miner's working life is 40 years, the chances are nearly 7 to 1 against his escaping injury and not much more than 20 to 1 against his being killed outright. No other trade approaches this in dangerousness. The next most dangerous is the shipping trade, one sailor in a little under 1,300 being killed every year. The figures I have given apply, of course, to mine workers as a whole. For those actually working underground, the proportion of injuries would be very much higher. Every miner of long standing that I have talked to had either been in a fairly serious accident himself or had seen some of his mates killed, and in every mining family they tell you tales of fathers, brothers, or uncles killed at work. And he fell 700 feet, and they wouldn't never have collected tea pieces only he were wearing a new suit of oilskins, etc. 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 Some of these tales are appalling in the extreme. One miner, for instance, described to me how a mate of his, a daedler, was buried by a fall of rock. They rushed to him and managed to uncover his head and shoulders so that he could breathe, and he was alive and spoke to them. Then they saw that the roof was coming down again and had to run to save themselves. The daedler was buried a second time. Once again they rushed to him and got his head and shoulders free, and again he was alive and spoke to them. Then the roof came down a third time, and this time they could not uncover him for several hours, after which, of course, he was dead. But the miner who told me the story, he had been buried himself on one occasion. But he was lucky enough to have his head jammed between his legs so that there was a small space in which he could breathe, did not think it was a particularly appalling one. Its significance, for him, was that the daedler had known perfectly well that the place where he was working was unsafe, and had gone there in daily expectation of an accident. And it worked on his mind to that extent that he got to kissing his wife before he went to work. And she told me afterwards that it were over 20 years since he'd kissed her. The most obviously understandable cause of accidents is explosions of gas, which is always more or less present in the atmosphere of the pit. There is a special lamp which is used to test the air for gas, and when it is present in at all large quantities it can be detected by the flame of an ordinary Davy lamp burning blue. If the wick can be turned up to its full extent and the flame is still blue, the proportion of gas is dangerously high. It is, nevertheless, difficult to detect, because it does not distribute itself evenly throughout the atmosphere but hangs about in cracks and crevices. Before starting work, a miner often tests for gas by poking his lamp into all the corners. The gas may be touched off by a spark during blasting operations, or by a pick striking a spark from a stone, or by a defective lamp, or by gob fires, spontaneously generated fires which smolder in the coal dust and are very hard to put out. The great mining disasters which happen from time to time, in which several hundred men are killed, are usually caused by explosions, hence one tends to think of explosions as the chief danger of mining. Actually, the great majority of accidents are due to the normal everyday dangers of the pit, in particular, to falls of roof. There are, for instance, potholes, circular holes from which a lump of stone big enough to kill a man shoots out with the promptitude of a bullet. With, so far as I can remember, only one exception, all the miners I have talked to declared that the new machinery, and speeding up, generally, have made the work more dangerous. This may be partly due to conservatism, but they can give plenty of reasons. To begin with, the speed at which the coal is now extracted means that for hours at a time a dangerously large stretch of roof remains unpropped. Then there is the vibration, which tends to shake everything loose, and the noise, which makes it harder to detect signs of danger. One must remember that a miner's safety underground depends largely on his own care and skill. An experienced miner claims to know by a sort of instinct and the roof is unsafe. The way he puts it is that he can feel the weight on him. He can, for instance, hear the faint creaking of the props. The reason why wooden props are still generally preferred to iron girders is that a wooden prop which is about to collapse gives warning by creaking, whereas a girder flies out unexpectedly. The devastating noise of the machines makes it impossible to hear anything else, and thus the danger is increased. When a miner is hurt, it is of course impossible to attend to him immediately. He lies crushed under several hundredweight of stone in some dreadful cranny underground, and even after he has been extricated, it is necessary to drag his body a mile or more, perhaps, through galleries where nobody can stand upright. Usually, when you talk to a man who has been injured, you find that it was a couple of hours or so before they got him to the surface. Sometimes, of course, there are accidents to the cage. The cage is shooting several hundred yards up or down at the speed of an express train, and it is operated by somebody on the surface who cannot see what is happening. He has very delicate indicators to tell him how far the cage has got, but it is possible for him to make a mistake, and there have been cases of the cage crashing into the pit bottom at its very maximum speed. This seems to me a dreadful way to die. For as that tiny steel box whizzes through the blackness, there must come a moment and the 10 men who are locked inside it know that something has gone wrong, and the remaining seconds before they are smashed to pieces hardly bear thinking about. A miner told me he was once in a cage in which something went wrong. It did not slow up when it should have done, and they thought the cable must have snapped. As it happened, they got to the bottom safely, but when he stepped out he found that he had broken a tooth. He had been clenching his teeth so hard in expectation of that frightful crash. Apart from accidents, miners seem to be healthy, as obviously they have got to be, considering the muscular efforts demanded of them. They are liable to rheumatism, and a man with defective lungs does not last long in that dust-impregnated air, but the most characteristic industrial disease is nystagmus. This is a disease of the eyes which makes the eyeballs oscillate in a strange manner when they come near a light. It is due presumably to working in half-darkness, and sometimes results in total blindness. Miners who are disabled in this way or any other way are compensated by the colliery company, sometimes with a lump sum, sometimes with a weekly pension. This pension never amounts to more than 29 shillings a week. If it falls below 15 shillings, the disabled man can also get something from the dole or the pack. If I were a disabled miner, I should very much prefer the lump sum, for then at any rate I should know that I had got my money. Disability pensions are not guaranteed by any centralized fund, so that if the colliery company goes bankrupt, that is the end of the disabled miner's pension, though he does figure among the other creditors. In Wigan I stayed for a while with a miner who was suffering from nystagmus. He could see across the room but not much further. He had been drawing compensation of 29 shillings a week for the past 9 months, but the colliery company were now talking of putting him on partial compensation of 14 shillings a week. It all depended on whether the doctor passed him as fit for light work on top. Even if the doctor did pass him, there would, needless to say, be no light work available, but he could draw the dole and the company would have saved itself 15 shillings a week. Watching this man go to the colliery to draw his compensation, I was struck by the profound differences that are still made by status. Here was a man who had been half-blinded in one of the most useful of all jobs and was drawing a pension to which he had a perfect right, if anybody has a right to anything. Yet he could not, so to speak, demand this pension. He could not, for instance, draw it when and how he wanted it. He had to go to the colliery once a week at a time named by the company, and when he got there he was kept waiting about for hours in the cold wind. For all I know, he was also expected to touch his cap and show gratitude to whomever paid him. At any rate, he had to waste an afternoon and spend sixpence in bus fares. It is very different for a member of the bourgeoisie, even such a down-at-heel member as I am. Even when I am on the verge of starvation, I have certain rights attaching to my bourgeois status. I do not earn much more than a miner earns, but I do at least get it paid into my bank in a gentlemanly manner and can draw it out when I choose. And even when my account is exhausted, the bank people are still passably polite. This business of petty inconvenience and indignity, of being kept waiting about, of having to do everything at other people's convenience, is inherent in working-class life. A thousand influences constantly press a working man down into a passive role. He does not act, he is acted upon. He feels himself the slave of mysterious authority and has a firm conviction that they will never allow him to do this, that and the other. Once when I was hop-picking I asked the sweated pickers, they earned something under sixpence an hour, why they did not form a union. I was told immediately that they would never allow it. Who were they? I asked. Nobody seemed to know. But evidently, they were omnipotent. A person of bourgeois origin goes through life with some expectation of getting what he wants, within reasonable limits. Hence the fact that in times of stress educated people tend to come to the front. They are no more gifted than the others and their education is generally quite useless in itself, but they are accustomed to a certain amount of deference and consequently have the cheek necessary to a commander. That they will come to the front seems to be taken for granted, always and everywhere. In Le Sagaret's History of the Commune there is an interesting passage describing the shootings that took place after the Commune had been suppressed. The authorities were shooting the ringleaders, and as they did not know who the ringleaders were, they were picking them out on the principle that those of better class would be the ringleaders. An officer walked down a line of prisoners, picking out likely-looking types. One man was shot because he was wearing a watch, another because he had an intelligent face. I should not like to be shot for having an intelligent face, but I do agree that in almost any revolt the leaders would tend to be people who could pronounce their H's.